but loud enough for just the two of us in the quiet of the car. My dad looked over at me and gave me a small smile. I gave him one back, and we stayed that way for just a moment before he looked ahead, shifted the car out of park, and drove us home. Palmer, Andy, is all okay? Why was your dad at the diner? Tom hasn't stopped talking about him, which is really fun for me. Bree, your dad showed up at the diner? What? Palmer, is your car still there? What's going on? Toby, worried face. Car, hourglass, thinking person. Me, all okay. Long story, but we'll explain. Oh, also, I'm grounded for a week. Palmer. Wait, what? Bree, what'd you do? Palmer. But why is your car still at the diner? Bree. Want me to hotwire it? Me. You know how to do that? Toby. Smiling face with closed eyes. Smiling face with cold sweat. Car. Screw. Police officer. Shocked face. Face screaming in fear. Bree. I might be able to do it, Toby. You don't know. I just need a screwdriver, right? I've seen enough movies that I'm pretty sure I could figure it out. Me. Figure it out on McQueen first. Bree. Can you video chat later? We need explanations. Palmer. Seconded. Toby. Girl raising her hand. Me. Yes, definitely. I'll text you guys soon. I had just set my phone down on the kitchen counter when the doorbell rang. I smiled, wondering if it was Palmer. She'd sometimes drop by when she didn't think I was texting back fast enough. I was headed toward the foyer when I heard the door open on its squeaky hinges and realized my dad must have beaten me there. Andy? My dad called, and I increased my pace, suddenly hoping that Bree hadn't gone ahead and tried to hotwire my car. Is it Palmer? I asked as I rounded the corner.
Your, friend is here, my dad called, and I stopped short.
Clark was standing there, carrying a cellophane-wrapped bouquet of flowers and what looked like a CD. Hi, I said, confused, trying to figure out what he was doing there, until it hit me all at once. We were supposed to have a date tonight. We were supposed to have a date now. With everything that had happened today, I had totally forgotten. Oh, I said, then stopped when I realized I had no idea what to say after that.
It's nice to see you again, sir,
Clark said, holding out his hand to my dad, sounding nervous, talking much faster than he usually did.
I was just reading up on that education initiative you spearheaded last year. Sounded fascinating.
My dad's eyebrows went up.
Were you really?
I surely was, Clark said, and I could clearly tell how much preparation he'd done, which was making me feel even worse that I had forgotten our date.
Well,
my dad said, raising an eyebrow at Clark.
That's impressive. We'll have to discuss it in depth sometime.
Clark smiled, but I noticed he had turned a shade paler. I shot my dad a quick look, and he nodded.
I'll give you guys a minute,
he said, heading back toward the kitchen, but not closing the door all the way, I noticed. I looked at Clark, who was wearing another button-down shirt, green this time, and I could still see the comb tracks in his hair. I looked down at myself. I was wearing cutoffs and a t-shirt. Nothing hugely offensive, but not what I would ever wear on a date. So, I said, taking a step nearer to him. As I did, I remembered this morning, the gentle way he'd brushed my hair back, how close together we'd been.
I blinked and made myself focus on the present moment and how much I'd managed to mess it up. Okay, here's the thing. Today's been kind of crazy. Clark nodded, but his eyes traveled to my bare feet, and I saw his smile falter. He looked down at the flowers he was holding, and I saw some of the happiness in his expression fade, replaced by embarrassment. Oh, he said. Did you not want to— No, I said immediately. It's just— I tried very quickly to think of the best way to spin this, then gave up and realized I should probably go with the truth. It turns out I sort of didn't tell my dad I wasn't coming home last night. Clark's eyebrows flew up. Uh-oh. Yeah, I said, glancing back toward the kitchen. So I'm kind of grounded. I was embarrassed even to say it. Even though he was only 2 years older than me, Clark was basically an adult, living on his own with the freedom to do whatever he wanted. Nobody was grounding him or telling him what to do. This must have seemed beyond juvenile to him. I'm really sorry about this. Clark shrugged. It's fine, he said, giving me a smile. I mean, I'm disappointed, but I understand. We'll do it another time, when you're not grounded. When will that be? I felt relief spread through me. Until he'd said it, I hadn't realized how much I'd been preparing myself to hear him say something polite but vague, which I would have known meant we wouldn't be having another date. A week, I said with a shrug like this was nothing. Not so long. Clark glanced down at the flowers in his hand, then held them out to me. These are for you. Sorry if it's totally cliché to bring them. I looked down into the bouquet, and it was a moment before I could answer him. No, I said. A guy had never brought me flowers before, unless it was my prom corsage, which I didn't think counted since I'd had to order it myself and give explicit instructions for where and when to pick it up. These were beautiful, all purples and pinks and the occasional daisy. I mean, it's really nice. I looked down into the flowers for one moment more, not wanting him to see just how touched I was by them. And, Clark said, presenting the CD to me with a flourish. This is more of a joke than anything else. You don't have to listen to it. What is it? I asked, taking it from him, then recognizing the familiar font on the cover. This one showed a crow and a flaming sword. A Murder of Crows, the title read, by C.B. McAllister. I know you don't read, Clark said, and I raised an eyebrow at him. But I thought maybe you wouldn't have anything against listening. It's the audiobook, so it's like someone telling you a story. Ha ha, I said, turning it over and reading the back. I felt my eyes widen. This takes 19 hours? Yeah, Clark said, not seeming fazed by this. And those are just the first 2 discs. There's like 12, but I didn't want to scare you. Andy, my dad called. I looked up from the CD to see him hovering in the doorway, clearly not sure what he should do or what I wanted him to do. Clark came by to pick me up for a date, I said, trying to get this over with quickly. Because I didn't know I'd be grounded. Ah, my dad said, his eyes traveling down to the flowers in my hand. Sir, I just want you to know Andy was amazing last night, Clark said, giving me a smile, as I felt myself freeze. Last night? My dad asked. His voice was still totally calm, but this was the way he sounded in debates when he realized his opponent had just made a mistake. Right, I said quickly, trying to jump in before this got any worse. So here's the thing. When Andy helped out with my dog, who was sick, Clark went on. It took all my willpower not to bury my head in my hands. She was great. He looked from me to my dad, finally seeming to get that something was going on. Was that a secret? He whispered to me. I didn't know you stayed the night at Clark's, my dad said. I told you it was for work, I said, realizing as I did that I should have probably just told him the truth right from the beginning, as opposed to hoping he would never find out.
It was totally professional, Clark said, jumping in. Nothing else. I mean, that wasn't all what...
Nothing happened. I looked down at my feet, not quite able to believe that I was having to say this to my dad in front of Clark. I just went over there to take care of the dog, and then we took shifts, staying up to make sure he was okay. My dad looked at me evenly, his eyes narrowed slightly, like he was trying to see if I was telling the truth. After a moment, he must have decided I was, because he nodded slightly.
Okay, he said.
Okay? I'd expected a lot worse. I'd expected him to grill Clark and me for details, trying to find discrepancies in our stories, the way he had when he was a lawyer. And the truth was, something had happened last night. Nothing that I was even sure I'd be able to articulate to him, but something nonetheless.
I believe you.
I just started to relax when he went on,
but your grounding just got extended. It's 10 days now.
Remembering our earlier conversation and hoping I'd get points for trying, I ventured, 8?
Know when to fold 'em, kid.
My dad shook his head and started to head back to the kitchen.
You can walk him to his car.
Clark said. That's great, except my car is outside that gate thing.
Why?
My dad asked, sounding baffled.
Well, there was nobody inside the gatehouse, Clark explained. There was a note saying they'd be back in 5, so I just parked outside and walked. I didn't want to be late.
He gave me a tiny smile, and I felt the forgetting our date guilt hit me once again. My dad shook his head.
Andy, remind me to have a conversation with the neighborhood council about what passes for security around here.
I nodded quickly. Totally. So, can I still walk Clark to his car? My dad looked between me and Clark for what felt like an eternity before he finally nodded.
Fine,
he said. He raised his eyebrows at me.
No driving anywhere. And be back before 7 a.m. this time.
Fine, I said grudgingly, and then a second later added, I mean, thanks. My dad nodded, then walked into the kitchen again, tapping his watch as he went. I looked over at Clark as we crossed from the driveway onto the road. It was a long summer twilight, like the sun was fighting to stay around as long as possible, even as it slowly, steadily got darker.
So,
Clark said, nodding toward the street we were approaching. It was the main street that wound through Stanwich Woods, the one that carried you past the gatehouse and around in a circle until you returned to where you came from.
Want to show me around?
I hesitated for just a second. It had seemed like my dad was giving me permission to stay out a bit longer with his 7 a.m. comment. Sure, I said, as we walked onto the main road, gesturing for him to follow me. Though there's not all that much to see.
Well, I doubt that, Clark said, falling into step next to me.
We were walking a little closer than I did with most people. I could have reached out and touched him easily, not even needing to extend my arm.
Welcome to Stanwich Woods,
I said, doing my best imitation of Toby's docent voice. As you can see, actual woods were torn down to make it, but at least they acknowledged them with a nifty name. Clark turned to me, his eyebrows raised behind his glasses.
I guess you don't like it here? I looked around as we took the curve in the path. To our left was a pond, complete with tiny, picturesque footbridge and a weeping willow hanging over it. The streets were almost empty of cars, and in the houses we passed, all looking vaguely alike, I could see lights on in the windows and families sitting down to eat, people going about their evenings. The streets curved gently, and the wrought iron street lights arched over the road from either side, guaranteeing that when it was dark enough, the evening joggers and dog walkers would be able to see just fine. But you couldn't see the stars here like you'd been able to at our farmhouse. "It's fine," I said, after a moment of walking next to Clark in silence. Somehow, without even really being able to say how, I knew he'd wait until I was ready to answer him. And I didn't feel the impatience coming off of him the way I sometimes did with Topher when I was taking too long to gather my thoughts. I could somehow tell that Clark would be happy to walk next to me in silence until I knew what I was going to say. "We used to live way out in backcountry," I finally said by way of explanation. "And then we moved out here after..." I hesitated for just a second, then made myself continue. "After my mom," I said quickly, not letting myself linger on any of the words. And it just seems so fake, like the idea of what a picturesque village once looked like. Clark glanced over toward the duck pond, which was free from ducks at the moment. "I don't know. If you ask me, living way out in the middle of nowhere is overrated." "How far were you from civilization?" I asked, as we followed the curve of the road, and I took a tiny step closer to him, so small that even Clark might not have noticed it. "An hour to the nearest gas station," he said. 2 and change to the closest real town." "Wow," I said, shaking my head. "That is far." Clark laughed. "Tell me about it. I got to see, like, 2 movie theater movies a year." "Don't tell my friend Bree that," I said, smiling at him. "She'd make you get caught up on your film history, decade by decade." "Well, that doesn't sound so bad," he said, giving me a shrug. "I've got some time on my hands this summer." The comment hung in the air between us, and I noticed there was just an edge of bitterness to it. "So, about your book," I said, after a moment of silence in which I tried not to notice how close together our hands were, both swinging by our sides as we walked. Clark didn't say anything, and I was about to change the subject, start talking about something easier. But then I remembered how patient he'd been, walking next to me, and I bit my lip, forcing myself to keep quiet as I walked next to him. I didn't know how exactly, but I could tell he was trying to find the right words.
"What I told you last night?" he finally asked, and I nodded. "You're the only person who knows that. Everyone knows I'm having trouble. There are whole websites devoted to it, but I haven't told anyone else how bad it is."
"Your secret is safe," I said, raising my right hand. "Ex-Girl Scouts honor."
"Ex?"
"Long story," I said, feeling like now was not the time to tell him the story that involved Toby, a cooler of ice cream, and Bree massively failing to be an effective lookout. "Another time. But I'm pretty sure the oath is still good."
"I appreciate it," he said.
He shook his head, running a hand through his hair and causing the back to stick up funny.
"I knew what was implied when my publisher offered me her house. I could stay there for free all summer. At the end of it, I'd better have a book for them."
We walked for a moment, not speaking, and I was suddenly aware of how loud the cicadas were all around us. I looked at the fireflies winking on and off in the grass while I tried to figure out how best to ask this. "So, what's the problem?" I finally asked, knowing that Bree or Tom, who seemed to understand and appreciate an artistic temperament, would have found a gentler way to ask this. But I was having trouble getting my head around it. I sometimes didn't want to study, but I did it anyway. You didn't wait for the perfect studying mood to strike you. I heard a buzzing sound, and I looked up to see the streetlights all flickering to life above us, going on one by one until you could see more clearly what had been fading into the slowly falling darkness. The bench by the edge of the duck pond, the tree branches over our heads, the details of Clark's face.
"Well,"
Clark said, and then stopped. It was like I could practically feel him choosing his words carefully, like he wasn't used to talking about this.
"Lately, I've been thinking that I might be done."
"With writing?" I asked, just as a pair of headlights swung around the curve in the road. We stepped over to the side, and when the car was gone and we started walking again, we were a little closer still, now just inches away, even though we could have walked in the middle of the open, empty road, the streetlights casting our shadows on the ground in front of us.
"Yeah," he said. "I don't think it's this book, or the pressure to continue the series, or..."
Clark shook his head.
"It's like I don't have any more stories to tell, which might be the case. Some writers only get a couple. Maybe I just got two."
I looked ahead and realized that we were almost to the gatehouse. It was just beyond the curve in the road. The brighter streetlights and the road beyond Stanwich Woods where Clark's car was waiting, which would mean this was over.
"Want to see a terrible statue?" I asked, quickly crossing the road to take us on a detour, away from the gatehouse, hoping he would be turned around and wouldn't realize exactly what I was doing.
"Always,"
Clark said, deadpan. I led him down the street. Was it really a street if it had no houses on it? That ended with the statue of Winthrop Stanwich, with the small playground and picnic tables to the side of him. Only the main road had streetlights, so as soon as we stepped off it, we were back to only the fading light to guide us. "But maybe it's not true," I said, as we walked down the road to the statue. "Possibly it was because it was so empty." This was mostly meant to be a walking path, without even a yellow line painted down the center. But we were walking farther apart now, a person space between us, so that we could turn and see each other.
"That you only have two stories in you."
"It might be,"
Clark said, and I could hear the frustration in his voice.
"I keep trying, but it's like there's nothing there. I've even tried writing other stuff, other than my series, and it's not working. So I'm left with the conclusion that I really might be done."
"But," I started as we reached the statue. We both stopped in front of it, which was really the only proper reaction to seeing the statue of Winthrop Stanwich for the first time. Palmer's brother Fitz always joked that by the time they were done building Stanwich Woods, they'd run out of money and decided to let the statue building go to the lowest bidder. It was in bronze and life-size, or close to it. Winthrop Stanwich was depicted as a slightly rotund guy in a high collar, equally high vest, short breeches, and buckled shoes. There was a cape over his shoulders, slightly raised on both sides, which was probably meant to convey his movement, but just made him look like a weird Puritan Batman. He had a beard and a monocle, though Fitz had a theory that he was supposed to have glasses before someone saw what was happening and just decided to pull the funding and call it a day. But the best thing about the statue was Winthrop Stanwich's expression. He was reaching out his right hand, first two fingers extended like he was pointing at something. His expression, equal parts happy and confused. At least that's how I read it. Tom thought Winthrop was angry and attempting to scold someone, and Toby was convinced he was about to break into song. He was like an inkblot, and everyone saw in his expression what they wanted to. For a while, not coincidentally, when both Palmer's brothers were in high school, stuff kept showing up in Winthrop's hand. It really was the perfect height and position to hang things on, though Palmer's brothers had preferred to leave boxers dangling around his wrist. The Winthropping. It wouldn't have been very hard to find the culprit since it was down to the Stanwich Woods residence. Had subsided somewhat, but every now and then there would be a note in all the residents' mailboxes, asking them to stop putting Santa hats or Halloween costumes or just random takeout bags on Winthrop. But it was ultimately a losing battle, and someone else would show up before too long. He was unsullied now, though, pointing to whatever he was pointing to, unencumbered.
"Wow," Clark said, shaking his head. "You weren't kidding."
He looked over at me, and I felt my eyes straying involuntarily to his mouth. I took a small step closer to him as he looked away, down at his watch.
"I should probably get you home," he said, giving me a half-smile. "I don't want your dad to hate me."
We walked away from Winthrop, and I turned back for just a second to see him, arm still extended toward something, cape forever billowing in imaginary wind. When we reached the road again, I pointed for us to go left, otherwise known as the longer way around to the gatehouse, praying that Clark had a terrible sense of direction like Toby, and he wouldn't notice this. "It's just this way," I said as Clark paused. He raised an eyebrow at me, a smile pulling at the corner of his mouth.
"Really?"
he said, not exactly phrasing it as a question.
"Uh-huh,"
I said, walking with purpose now, knowing that what I'd tried to do was completely obvious, but not really caring. But I wasn't ready for this. Clark, the falling darkness, walking next to him, to be over yet. We walked in silence, and I noticed that he was right by my side, closer than ever. Even without turning to look, it was like I could feel his presence next to me, aware of every step he was taking. Our hands were both down by our sides, and they were so close to touching. I could feel the tiny breeze made by his arm as it swung, the night air cool on my skin. "I don't think you can just decide you're done with writing," I said, when I realized that Winthrop had interrupted a pretty important topic. "You don't think you could tell me a story, right here, right now?" Clark shook his head, and I knew he was about to tell me why I was wrong, but before he could, I jumped in. "Look, I'll start you off. Once upon a time..." I gestured for him to pick this up, but he was just staring back at me, clearly waiting for me to continue. "Once upon a time, there was a guy," I continued, when I realized this was on me.
"A guy?" Clark asked with a laugh. "There aren't guys in my world. There are elders and mages, princes and orcs, but..."
"But this isn't your world. We're just making up a story that doesn't matter, for fun." Clark didn't say anything, and after a moment I asked, "You don't think you can do it? I'm getting us started, and I don't even read." Clark stopped and looked at me, and I could see something in his expression, like he was fighting a competitive instinct. "Once upon a time," I said again, feeling like he was on the verge of joining in. "There was a guy named Carl."
"Carl?"
Clark said, incredulous. I shot him a look and he threw up his hands.
"Okay, fine. But it's Carl, with a K."
"What difference does that even make?"
"It makes a huge difference," Clark said,
with enough authority that I decided to take his word for it.
Okay, and Carl?
There was a long pause, and I bit my lip to stop myself from jumping in, making myself listen to the slap of my flip-flops against my heels, the cicadas in the grass all around us, the occasional crunch of leaves beneath our feet. I was practically willing him to say something, to jump in with the story, to try.
And Carl?
He took a shaky breath, then went on, all in a rush.
Carl was a wanted man. He was on the run.
I smiled, but tried to tone it down as we rounded a bend in the road. Because he'd stolen something, I said. Something valuable, with lots of value. Clark laughed, and it was like I could practically feel him relax next to me.
But he didn't know that he'd been spotted stealing the valuable thing with lots of value. Unbeknownst to him, an assassin named
Marjorie, I supplied, and Clark stopped dead in his tracks.
The assassin can't be named Marjorie. It's bad enough we've got a Carl.
What's wrong with Marjorie?
Assassins aren't named Marjorie.
Really good assassins probably are, because nobody would think they were assassins. Clark inclined his head toward me.
Well played, he said. So, okay, Carl and Marjorie,
Marjorie the super assassin,
are in the woods on a moonlit night,
he said, the words coming more quickly now.
Carl thinks he's gotten away with it.
But he hasn't.
Not even close, because he's about to meet Marjorie, and she's going to change his life.
I took a breath to continue the story when Clark's hand brushed against mine, and all the words left my head. I wasn't sure if it was an accident, so I kept my hand stretched down by my side, within easy reach, and what felt like a lifetime later, Clark's hand brushed mine again, sending a spark through me that I felt all the way in my toes. He kept his hand touching mine, and then, moving a millimeter at a time, curved his fingers around so that they were resting against my palm, just brushing it so lightly. Then he moved up over the curve of my thumb and ran his index finger over the inside of my wrist in a slow circle. I could feel my pulse fluttering beneath his fingertips, and I had to remind myself that I knew how to breathe, that I'd been doing it my whole life. And then our palms were touching, perfectly lined up, though I could feel how much bigger his hand was than mine, feel his fingertips curving over the tops of mine. Despite what Bree had always called my weird, large tree frog hands. We stayed that way for just a moment, and then, like we'd talked about it before, like we'd mutually picked the time, our fingers interlocked, and we were holding hands. We walked that way, not speaking, our joined hands swinging gently between us, every nerve in my body suddenly awake. I was concentrating on putting one foot in front of the other, because otherwise all my thoughts would have been focused on the fact that Clark and I were holding hands, that somehow, on this walk, something between us had changed. So, then what happens? I asked, when I saw that we were approaching the guardhouse again. Clark looked over at me.
What happens with what?
With Marjorie. And Carl, I said, as he slowed and turned to me, still not letting go of my hand.
I don't know, he said, stopping and looking down at me. I guess we'll have to wait and find out.
I nodded and looked up at him and knew this was the moment. If I let this happen, whatever this was, whatever it might be, would start. I could feel my heart pound as Clark dropped my hand and moved it toward my waist, brushing the hem of my tank top between his fingers. Normally, I kissed first. I didn't like the moment before, the wondering if a guy was going to get up the courage to kiss you while you were just standing there, waiting and hoping. I liked to take matters into my own hands, squash that moment, and get right into the makeout session. But now... Now, being in this moment, on the cusp of something happening, made me wonder why I'd been rushing through it all these years. Or maybe I hadn't. Maybe I'd just been waiting for this moment. Right now. Clark looked down at me, brushing his hand over my forehead, smoothing back my hair like he'd done before. And I knew this was my last chance to change my mind. And as much as a part of me wanted this, there was another part that knew this would be different from my 3-week boyfriend's. That it already was. But I didn't turn away or walk in the other direction or stop the moment from happening. Moving so slowly, he tilted his head down toward me. I stretched up to him, and we stayed like that for just a second. Not kissing, not yet, just hovering in the moment before, only a breath apart. And then he leaned forward. Or I did. And then his lips were on mine. We lingered there, our lips brushing gently. And then he raised his hand and cupped it under my chin, drawing me closer toward him, and we started kissing for real. And my arms were around his neck, and then his were around my waist, and he was pulling me closer, lifting me off my feet. And when he set me back down, my knees were wobbly, like the ground had gotten less solid in the interim. It was a kiss that made me feel like I'd never been properly kissed before. And as we paused to take a breath, a minute later, an hour, he leaned his forehead against mine. I looked up at him, and a thought passed through my brain before I could stop or analyze it. It's you. Of course it is. There you are. And as I touched his cheek and his hand tightened on my waist, I leaned forward to kiss him again, knowing as I did that something was ending, while something else had already begun. Tamsin cursed under her breath as she watched the owl sitting on the branch regard her with what she was almost certain was disdain. This was supposed to be the one area where she was showing any kind of natural inclination, and she had been failing miserably all morning. "You're distracted," the elder said from the tree stump where he had sat, motionless, for almost an hour now. "Maybe," Tamsin acknowledged, as she watched the owl ruffle its feathers in a distinctly haughty way. "Does it have something to do with Sir Charlie Ward?" the elder asked, his voice innocent. "How did you..." Tamsin started, then gave up, realizing what a foolish question it had been. She had been aware the elder knew everything, but until that moment she had thought it was restricted to things like the names of all the plants in the kingdom. She hadn't realized it also included knowledge of her first kiss. "Be careful there," the elder cautioned. "It's fine," Tamsin said, turning back to the bird. She would prefer not to discuss Charlie with anyone, but especially not someone old enough to be her grandfather. "It's always a risk," the elder said, but more quietly now, like perhaps he was no longer speaking to her. "Wherever there is great emotion, because there is power in that, and few people handle power well." "It was only a kiss," Tamsin said, focusing back on the owl. "Oh," the elder said, shaking his head. That is where you are mistaken, believing that such a thing, just a kiss, has ever, for even a second, existed in this world. C.B. McAllister, A Murder of Crows, Hightower and Jax, New York. Chapter 10. Almost without my noticing it, the summer started to find its rhythm. I had dogs to walk, I had my friends to hang out with, and my dad and I were finding a little more to say to each other day by day. But mostly, I had Clark.
So, Carl and Marjorie duck into a roadside tavern, he said to me as we walked three hyperactive terriers, all straining desperately at their leashes, like the trees up ahead of us were just so much better. But they're going under false names, I reminded him, and Clark nodded.
Of course. They can't let their real identities be known, not with the bounty on their heads.
And it's raining.
Naturally,
he said, taking my hand and squeezing it.
It's a proverbial dark and stormy night.
I looked over at him and smiled. And then what happens? It had been 2 weeks since Clark and I kissed, and things were going well. I had been grounded for the first 8 days, dropped down from 10 with some careful negotiation on my part. So he'd started coming with me when I walked Birdie. We'd hold hands while we walked, stopping to kiss multiple times, or as much as we could with Bert yanking on the leash. Clark would sometimes come with me on other walks, which I always appreciated, since a full day of walking dogs by myself led to me talking way too much to animals who were never going to answer me back. But even though we hadn't been able to go on another real date that first week, we'd ended up talking on the phone nearly every night. Conversations that happened while he took Birdie for his nightly walk, and I sat up on the roof and looked out at the stars. I'd never had conversations like that with a boyfriend before. Conversations that were easy and free-flowing, hours passing in what felt like seconds. I was still getting my head around how Clark seemed happy to talk about almost anything, including sharing how he felt about things. The only thing he really hadn't told me much about was his father. Whenever we got close to the subject, I could sense Clark's walls, which were so rarely present, start to go up, and I changed the subject quickly. But I'd begun to fill in the picture of Clark Bruce McAllister in a way I never had with any of my other boyfriends. I knew now that his favorite color was green, that when he was little he'd wanted to be a wildfire fighter.
They fight fires from helicopters. How cool is that?
That he talked to his older sister, Kara, on the phone every Sunday. That he still refused to watch Jaws because it had given him nightmares for weeks as a kid. That he hated cinnamon. And that he had found a spot just below my earlobe that drove me crazy when he kissed it. I didn't know these types of things about any other guy, including Topher, and none of them would have known them about me. It was different with Clark. And one way I knew this, beyond a shadow of a doubt, was the fact that we were getting close to the 3-week mark, and I had no interest in seeing it end. It was pretty much the opposite, as a matter of fact. It was feeling like something was just getting started.
And we're doing groups this year, Palmer said enthusiastically as she pushed up the brim of her sun hat. Chosen randomly, which means, since there will be two of you, the challenges are going to be that much harder.
We had been at the beach since 9, and by my count, Palmer had been talking about the summer scavenger hunt for at least 45 minutes. She'd sent a group text at 8 a.m., saying that it was the perfect beach day, she'd already staked out a spot, and we should join her and bring an iced coffee. Somewhat miraculously, everyone else's schedule had aligned, and I'd shifted some walks around to make mine work as well. We'd spread out on the patch of sand Palmer had been zealously guarding, and now had a stretch of blankets and towels and snacks and magazines. "Sounds good," Toby said, her eyes fixed on the water in front of her. "Absolutely." "What are you looking at?" I asked, pushing my sunglasses up and trying to see what was in her sight line. "What do you think?" Bree asked, shooting me a look. In the 2 weeks since Wyatt had come back to town, Toby's crush seemed to be getting stronger by the day. She had calmed down enough that she was no longer acting strange around him. But she'd taken to spending much too much time on her hair every day, and trying to devise increasingly complicated ways that they could be alone together. She was sending us long emoji missives about her feelings, and I don't know if she was getting better at it or if I was just getting used to it, but I'd been able to accurately decipher a message yesterday that detailed her current emotional state, using mostly just dolphins, the weird gourd fruit, and clapping hands. She was so single-minded about this, about him, that I wasn't sure anymore if her crush was really about Wyatt, the guy who had, by my count at the diner the night before, said only 14 words. There was a piece of me that wondered, though I would never suggest this to her, if maybe she was just used to the idea that she was in love with Wyatt, without stopping to see if it was still true and if he was really what she wanted. "I'm just making sure nobody drowns," Toby said, her eyes not straying from the water, even when Palmer started to tickle her bare feet. I looked out to the water and smiled. Lark, Tom, and Wyatt were all on stand-up paddleboards, but not a single one of them was paddling along placidly like in the pictures hung up in the tiny building where you could rent kayaks, paddleboards, and boats. Instead, Clark and Tom were using their oars as jousting spears, trying to knock each other into the water. And Wyatt was paddling, but sitting down, with one leg over either side, like he'd really wanted a kayak and was doing his best to approximate one. "Who rented those to them?" Bree asked, sounding baffled. My phone beeped with a text, and I pushed my sunglasses up to get a better look at the screen. Then fumbled the phone when I saw who it was from. Topher.
"Hey, heard you were staying in town. You around this weekend? Let me know. It's been a while."
I looked up from my phone, but Clark was still in the water, and none of my friends seemed to have noticed I'd gotten a text. I read the message again, then started typing fast, holding my phone off to the side. "Me. Hey, I'm around, but kind of with someone now." Topher.
"Got it. Let me know when you're free to hang again."
Me. "Sure, yeah, will do." I set the phone down, then turned it to silent and dropped it back in my bag, trying to figure out why this was bothering me. It wasn't like it was that unexpected for Topher to text me, so why did it suddenly feel like another part of my life had intruded when I didn't want it to? And I didn't want to compare the two, but the proof of how different Clark and Topher were was right in front of me, in the very fact that Clark was hanging out with my friends. It wasn't like it had been great right from the beginning, and that was my fault. Normally I would have planned it better, but I was in full-on early make-out haze, and didn't think about what it would mean for Clark to meet all my friends at once. This had never been an issue for my other boyfriends, but they'd gone to school like normal people, in regular classrooms with more than just their sister. So when I introduced Clark at the diner, Toby, Bree, Wyatt, Palmer, and Tom were all there, which in retrospect was too much too soon. Clark barely said a word the whole night, and when he did talk, it mostly seemed to be reciting facts I'd told him about my friends back to them. It didn't help that Tom was almost equally quiet, stunned into fanboy silence at the reality of sitting across from one of his favorite authors. So, all in all, not a huge success. And it wasn't that Clark couldn't talk to people. Last week, I'd come in from walking Bert to hear him on a conference call with his editor and publisher, and something called a marketing team, as they discussed a cover redesign. Even though I had a feeling he was the youngest person on the call by a decade, he was very much in charge, clearly running things. Which was hard to reconcile with the fact that he seemed really intimidated by my friends. Especially, for some reason, Bree and Toby.
They were kidding, right?
He asked one night as we sat outside Paradise Ice Cream. He with his mocha almond ripple, me with my cookie dough, and a pint of mint chip I was bringing home for my dad.
They don't really want me to call them Toe-Bree.
They were kidding, I assured him, as I helped myself to a bite of his ice cream.
They do kind of seem to share one brain, though, he said, reaching over for a spoonful of mine. I swear, they had a conversation without ever saying anything.
I nodded and moved my ice cream out of reach. They do that. But they liked you. All my friends did. Clark nodded but didn't seem convinced, and even when I tried to do better the next time and not present him with five people he'd never met before, just bowling with Tom, Palmer, and Toby, he was nervous and awkward, reminding me of how he'd been in the early days with me. I was thinking that maybe it just wouldn't work out. But then, a few days after bowling, came what Bree later called the beginning of a beautiful bromance. I stopped by Clark's to pick up Bert and found Tom and Clark on the couch in the book room, eyes fixed on the TV, which the room did, it turned out, have. It just looked like a mirror when it wasn't turned on. Hi, I said, as I looked between them, trying to figure out how this had happened.
Hey,
Tom said, nodding at me like it was totally normal for him to be hanging out at Clark's house.
Hi there,
Clark said, standing up and giving me a quick kiss.
Here to get the beast?
Uh-huh, I said. I was actually a little disappointed to see Tom there, as I'd been hoping for a little pre-walk kissing action. What are you guys doing?
Well,
Clark said, nodding at the TV. It was paused, but I couldn't tell what was on it. It just looked like gray and raininess.
Tom doesn't have to rehearse today, so we're watching The Batsmen.
The what?
All the Batman movies, Tom clarified. We're still debating the plural. Batmans?
Clark asked, heading back to the couch.
Batman?
Tom offered.
I've got it, Clark said triumphantly. Batsman.
Tom shook his head.
I really don't think that sounds right.
Well, have fun, I said, as I went off to find Bert. I was having better luck with him when I could sneak up on him with the leash. If he didn't know there was a walk afoot, he didn't have time to play the run-away-from-the-leash game. I waved at them when I left, but they were back to watching, and I wasn't even sure they noticed. I was happy to see it, though, Clark and Tom hanging out. It seemed like a good thing. I was less convinced when I came by the next day. I was adding Bert to a group walk for the first time, to find Tom and Clark still on the couch, both of them looking a little glassy-eyed. "Are you guys still doing this?" I asked, feeling my jaw drop open. How many Batmen are there?
We moved on from that,
Tom said, blinking at me a few times.
Now we're watching the James Bond movies.
I looked from him to Clark, hoping for an explanation.
Why? Well,
Clark said,
pushing himself off the couch and coming over toward me.
We were talking about whether it was fundamentally wrong for a Brit to play Batman.
He's the closest thing we American actors, Tom said, clearly including himself in this group, have to a classic part. He's our Hamlet.
And then we were talking about how they'd never cast an American to play Bond.
Who's they? I asked, feeling like I didn't have time for this, with four dogs waiting in the car.
So we started watching them,
Tom finished, like this was the only logical explanation.
In order.
Shouldn't you really be watching the Supermans? I asked, then paused. Supermen?
See, it's hard, Clark said.
I wanted to, Tom said, pointing in Clark's general direction.
It's not often you get a real live Clark in your midst, especially one wearing glasses.
That's what I'm saying. But then we remembered that Superman is kind of lame.
Bond versus Superman,
Clark said, looking over at Tom, then stopping to yawn hugely.
Who wins?
Which Bond?
Which Superman?
Clark countered. Have either one of you slept? I asked. Birdie trotted around the corner, and I saw my opportunity and grabbed him by the collar.
Sleep is overrated, Tom said, yawning as well.
I've got to take him out, I said, stumbling a few steps behind Birdie, who was whining and stretching toward the door.
I'll call you later,
Clark said, giving me a quick kiss. And even though he looked exhausted, his hair was sticking up all over the place, and his eyes were bleary behind his glasses. He also looked really happy.
Sure, I said, giving his hand a squeeze. We'll talk then.
And while I was glad that Clark had found someone to discuss all the different Doctors Who with, I realized I was also happy for Tom. Watching them crack each other up was making me realize that I hadn't ever seen him with a guy friend before.
I think they're coming in,
Toby said now, her voice going immediately more high-pitched as she dug in her bag and emerged with a lip gloss. She uncapped it, then squinted out to the water, where Clark and Tom were starting to swim in with their boards.
Oh, never mind. It's just Tark.
I rolled over on my side to face her, already shaking my head.
Please don't give them a nickname.
I think it's catchy, Bree said. It sounds kind of badass.
You have to admit it's better than Clom, Palmer said, lowering her sunglasses.
That had been Toby's first attempt, and I had done my best to quash it.
It's not about what the nickname is, I said, even though Clom had been pretty awful.
Why are you giving them one at all? Why not one with my name and Clark's?
All my friends looked at me at once, and I focused on smoothing out the wrinkles on my towel.
Hold the phone,
Palmer said, sitting up straight and looking at me.
You're really in a couple's nickname kind of a place? I didn't read anything about hell freezing over today,
Toby said, shaking her head.
I'll check online, Bree added.
Never mind, I said, hoping by now I'd gotten tan enough so they couldn't tell I was blushing.
Candy,
Toby pronounced triumphantly, and I made a face.
Ark,
Bree supplied. I shook my head. Just forget it, I said. I shouldn't have... I lost total track of whatever I'd been about to say next, because Clark emerged from the water and started walking toward me. And all ability to verbalize left my head. I had made it clear to Clark early on that all we would be doing was kissing. He'd been a little taken aback, but seemed okay with it. And for the most part, that was all that had been happening. All our clothes had stayed put, So today was the first day I'd actually seen that Clark was in way better shape than writers of fantasy novels were supposed to be, as far as I